And Anthony Peak back with us. We're going to talk about his latest work called Opening the Doors of Perception, The Key to Cosmic Awareness, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. He was with us a couple years ago when we talked about his work, The Immortal Mind. Now we're talking about Opening the Doors of Perception. Anthony Peak grew up near Liverpool, England, educated at Wirral Grammar School, Warwick University, and the London School of Economics, member of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, that was the late Edgar Mitchell's group, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Anthony, always a pleasure. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, George. Great to talk to you again.
Good. Looking forward to this as well. How are things in lovely United Kingdom?
Very crisp and cool this morning, which is not too bad.
What are they saying about our election out that way?
I'm staggered, to be honest. But then again, after Brexit, nothing surprises me.
Well, Leo, that's true, too. Thank God we're talking about the opening the doors of perception, something somewhat metaphysical. Those are always fun topics, aren't they?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And what does this mean, opening the doors of perception?
Right. Well, it goes back many, many years ago. Back in 1951, there was a guy called Humphrey Osmond and an associate of his called John Smithies. And these two guys were psychiatrists at the Souris Valley Hospital in Weybourne in Saskatchewan. They were two English guys. And what they'd done is they'd gone over there to work with patients that had problems with alcoholism and people who had schizophrenia. And what they did was they did a series of research and came to the conclusion that the way of treating schizophrenics was actually to give them hallucinogenic substances. Because what they discovered was that you could bring somebody down from a real problem with schizophrenia and hallucinations by giving them LSD. It made the hallucinations less intense. And Osmond and Smithies came to the conclusion that what was happening here was that the human brain effectively acted as a kind of a reducing valve. It stopped a lot of the perceptions that we normally perceive coming into the mind. Now, what subsequently happened was they wrote a paper in April 1952, and this was read by a British writer called Aldous Huxley, who was living in L.A. at the time.
Who happened to die on Kennedy's assassination date.
It was exactly, yeah. I mean, that was one of the sad things about him. He died on such a auspicious day that his death sort of was missed, really.
Right.
Because Huxley was hugely popular in the UK. You know, he was a very high-ranking writer. But as he was getting older, he started to lose his eyesight, and he was interested in perception. And he'd heard about this substance, a substance called mescaline, that the guys in Saskatchewan had been working on, and invited them down. And in May 1953, they brought some down, and he tested it out on himself. And it literally blew his mind. So he wrote a book called The Doors of Perception, describing his experiences. And indeed, you're probably aware that the band The Doors, Jim Morrison named his band after The Doors of Perception book. And the central point of the book is that the brain acts as a reducing valve, and that consciousness is much more expansive than our normal experience tells us. It's much, much wider. And in the book, Opening the Doors of Perception, I update the work of Aldous Huxley in the light of 21st century neurology, neurochemistry. And as people know with my books, everything I write about goes straight back to academic papers. So I always give people the references. You know, this is not material that I'm channeling from anywhere or material that, you know, that I'm reading about in odd newspapers and things. This is the real deal. These are real academic papers and real extensive research that's been done in this area.
And the forward of this book, of course, our dear friend Whitley Strieber is going to be a guest with me next week. A wonderful guy, Anthony. Tell me of that relationship. How'd you get to know him?
Interestingly enough, I was on his radio program twice, and the last time I was on, we got talking about his experiences with alien entities. And we also got discussing his book, The Master of the Key, and his encounter in, I think it was Montreal, in a hotel room with this entity. And we got talking about alien encounters. And I said, well, we could argue this is part of a much wider phenomenon, that this is to do with us experiencing alternate dimensions of reality, and that the brain opens up under certain circumstances for these entities to come through. And Whitley was so interested in this that he agreed to write the foreword of the book. And his foreword is wonderful. I mean, it really was great, considering he was under such stress at the time with the death of Anne and everything else as well.
Yeah.
And I know how difficult that time was for him. But he was wonderful and massively supportive.
When we talk about, of course, opening the doors of perception, the key to cosmic awareness, how many people out there are truly tuned in to their cosmic awareness?
A surprising amount. It amazes me. I mean, I've been writing now for 12 years, and I've written 9 books. And all the books have a central theme, which is about altered states of consciousness, you know, mediumship, out-of-the-body experiences, remote viewing, the areas that normal psychology tends to avoid. And I find that these experiences are extraordinarily common. And people have these experiences and are suddenly shaken out of their normal worldview. And of course, it's impossible for them to explain to other people because they're so subjective. But they know they're real. I know of nobody who, when they have extreme hallucinations, does not believe at the time, at least, that those hallucinations are real.
That's right.
You know, we have people experience deja vu. 70% of the population of the planet will at one stage or other experience a deja vu sensation. And many of these sensations are precognitive. Now, modern science is in denial about this. And what I'm trying to do with my books is to say, come on, guys. I'm doing the science like you're doing the science. But in order for science to be completely explanatory in terms of all experiences, we have to include consciousness. We have to include how the brain, which is effectively inanimate matter, creates a consciousness, a self-referential consciousness. That is supposedly impossible. So therefore, if that is impossible, it is also logical to conclude that other experiences that we believe are impossible because they don't fit in with our science are real, and our science can only progress if we acknowledge the fact that these experiences, many of them, are real.
When Huxley, of course, wrote his books, at the time he was a novelist, he turned into philosopher. Did he change much in his later years? Now, of course, he moved to Los Angeles as well, didn't he?
He did, yeah. He was in Los Angeles when he invited Osmond down to work with him. He did, massively. If you read his earlier books, and you read, he's very, very anti-hallucinogenic substances. You know, it is very, very clear in Brave New World, one of his most influential books, he's quite negative about them. But in 1962, he wrote a book about a tropical island where people experienced out-of-body states and altered states of consciousness facilitated by substances like LSD and everything else. In fact, he named the substance as Soma, which in my book, The Infinite Mindfield, I discuss in great detail. And he changed completely. His worldview had changed. He came to the conclusion that, like William Blake, our doors of perception are closed. And these substances open the doors of perception and allow us to see the universe as it really is, infinite. But he's not alone in this. I mean, there's philosophers like Pierre de Chardin, people like Henri Bergson, C.D. Broad. This is an area that has been fascinating certain scientists for centuries. But of course, if you go back to the belief systems of the Vedanta and various other things, they conclude, you know, mind is the basis of everything. Consciousness creates everything around us. Therefore, everything that we see is technically an hallucination anyway. Of course, because the way we perceive the universe, the way the brain inwardly creates an image of the external world inside the brain, is creating an hallucination.
You use a phrase called the Huxleyan spectrum. What is that?
Right. The Huxleyan spectrum is a series of related experiences or illnesses or whatever we want to call them that seem to have a relationship, that seem to have a continuum. And what I say is that the doors of perception for most of us, that is people who are termed neurotypicals, are fairly solidly closed. With the exception of when we go to sleep and we dream, and sometimes when people have sleep paralysis and things like that. But generally, the doors are closed. Sometimes people, when they have near-death experiences, people like Eben Alexander as an example, their doors of perception are open for a short period of time, and then they close again. Other people, their doors of perception are open when they take substances such as dimethyltryptamine and ayahuasca and everything else, and these seem to open the doors, but then they close them again. But I argue that there are certain individuals out there who, because of certain neurological conditions, their doors of perception are automatically opened naturally. And I start with the spectrum with people like myself. I'm a classic migrainer. So when I get a migraine headache, I have what's called a pre-migraine headache aura. And in the aura, it's like going into an altered state of consciousness. In the book, I then carry it forward and I show there's links between very, very extreme migraine auras and something called temporal lobe epilepsy. And temporal lobe epilepsy, the doors of perception seem to be wider open. It seems that the doors are more ajar. And in the book, I cite many, many examples of individuals who have had extraordinary experiences during their aura state, when they experience temporal lobe epilepsy. In fact, there's a guy down in California called Myron Dial, who I quote a lot because of his experiences. Now, at the extreme end of temporal lobe epilepsy, it then moves into schizophrenia. There seems to be an overlap area in schizophrenia. There, the doors of perception are blasted wide open. As Smithies and Osman discovered with their patients, it's as if the doors are so wide open that the brain can no longer deal with the information overload that they're experiencing. But I then find that there are other areas that seem to fit into it as well. I mean, I'm fascinated, for instance, Alzheimer's disease seems to be involved in this as well, and we can talk about that a little bit later. I think autism is related here as well. So there is a whole spectrum of the way the doors are open in different ways. And the Huxleyan spectrum is my term for defining this, obviously in honor of Aldous Huxley, the guy that really started all this all those many years ago back in 1954.
It's amazing work. Now, you have dabbled a little bit also in the area of UFOs, but you've mentioned something about Alzheimer's disease, which I found strange, but tell me that tie-in.
Right, yeah, the tie-in is very, very strange. And the reason the tie-in is strange is it's something that happened to my own mother. Now, my mother lives on an isolated village, a fairly isolated village, up on the Wirral, near Liverpool. And one day she was walking home with my aunt back onto the village. They're both in their 80s, they're both widows, so they used to spend time together. My aunt had stopped to tie her shoelace, and as my aunt stopped, my mother looked over her head and towards Liverpool area, and she saw in the sky, she explained to me the next day, she saw in the sky what looked like a circular disc of smoke, and it was revolving. And then suddenly it shot off towards North Wales. She phoned me up and she said, "Tony, what exactly did I see?" Now, my mother doesn't know anything about UFOs. She's never been interested in the subject. It's just not something that's in her worldview. So I explained to her and I said, "Oh, I don't know, maybe you're partially sighted. So maybe what it was there was just something in your eye that you saw."
Right.
Now, the interesting thing here is that subsequently I discovered there was a friend of mine, and she was traveling across a bridge nearby, about 2 miles away. And on the same day, she saw the same object, as did the taxi driver she was in and her friend, a lady called Morgan Hawkins. Now, this was interesting because this was evidence that whatever my mother saw was really out there in three-dimensional reality. Anyway, a week later, she phones me up in a state of hysteria, and she'd woken up in the middle of the night. Now, she lives alone. She'd woken up in the middle of the night, and she said she couldn't move. Now, she was obviously in a state of sleep paralysis, and we understand, and I write about sleep paralysis in my other books, and I understand that the mechanism of sleep paralysis is something called REM intrusion, where your sleeping mind, you become awake in a dream, and the reality you see outside is sort of superimposed in your dream sequence. So I can understand that. You also have a feeling of paralysis, which, again, I could understand. My mother was describing this. But what she then described was weird. She said that she noticed the bedroom door was open, and then she saw a series of three or four spindly little fingers come around the edge of the door, and this creature popped its head around the door and looked at her and blinked with surprise. This is how she describes it. It was about 3 foot tall. It had a huge face with huge black eyes like an insect, two little holes for a nose, and a slit for a mouth. And she said he dodged back and disappeared. And she said, "Tony, what did I see?" Now, I immediately recognized this as being the classic Grey. And of course, we know from our mutual friend Whitley's book, Communion, this is the cover creature of Communion. But my mother hasn't read Communion. She doesn't watch films. She's not interested in these kind of things. This was something like a Jungian archetype that she had created or had manifested in some way. So I immediately started to look into this. And I thought, I think I know what's going on here. Now, there's something I know called Charles Bonnet syndrome.
Now, what is that?
It happens with elderly people and people who have Alzheimer's or are developing Alzheimer's. So I took my mother off to the doctors, and I said, I think my mother is developing Alzheimer's. She looks like she's having Charles Bonnet syndrome. Now, the other reason I took her to the doctors was, it was really weird. A few days later, I'm talking to her, and she's saying, "Do you know, the children really annoy me these days?" And I said, "What children?" She said, "The little children. They sing to me. They're around me all the time.
Oh, boy.
And they follow me when I'm shopping." And I said, "Right." And she said, "But the old man in the kitchen, he's really friendly." And I said, "What old man?" She said, "There's an old man in the kitchen. He always smiles at me." Now, Charles Bonnet syndrome was discovered, strangely enough, by a guy called Charles Bonnet in about the 1780s, 1790s. And Bonnet noticed that elderly people who are partially sighted seem to have these three-dimensional, out-in-reality hallucinations of little people. Now, clearly here, things that my mother is seeing that Charles Bonnet people see, they're aliens. They're greys. They're pixies. They're fairies. They're kind of the elementals. Now, you and I probably know the work of people like John Keel in his book, Project Trojan Horse, right. Jacques Vallée in his book, Passport to Magonia. They all write about the fact that aliens have been with us and they're part of our own psyche. Now, I think this is what is happening with Whitley. Now, what is really breaking news is my publisher, Watkins, are so amazed at how well this book is doing, this new book. They've already commissioned me to write a sequel, which is going to be Through the Doors of Perception.
We'll wait till after this show, Anthony. Then they'll really realize what's happening, huh?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
And, of course, you can join all the dots now. You're suddenly saying, well, what is this door? Is the doors of perception, are they linked in some way? When people have out-of-the-body experiences, when people do distance viewing, remote viewing, all the things that you have on your shows. I believe I can put together a scientifically based model that can explain it, which the skeptics cannot diss and cannot just poo-poo.
What, in your opinion, has caused this linkage between consciousness, extraterrestrials, the universe? What ties it all together?
I think it's to do with an effect called non-locality. Non-locality was something that has been around in quantum physics now since about 1937, I think. And in 1937, Albert Einstein, together with two associates, Podolsky and Rosen, wrote a paper. And in the paper, he was wanting to disprove effectively the ideas such as Schrodinger's cat and the idea that the way quantum physics sees the world. Because, of course, you know, in quantum physics, according to people like Niels Bohr and the Copenhagen interpretation, says that objects come into existence when they are observed. When they're not observed, they don't exist. There's just a statistical chance that an atom or an electron might be found in one place or another. But until it is observed and measured, it doesn't exist. Okay? Then when somebody observes it, the statistical wave collapses into a point particle. Now, as an aside, what is fascinating about this is that they found that this weird effect takes place with molecules, large molecules. For instance, around about 1999, I think it was, 2000, a guy called Anton Zeilinger at the University of Vienna took objects called buckyballs. Now, these are huge molecules. They have 60 atoms in them. And they found that these molecules did not exist until they were observed, and then they became a point particle. So everything we observe around us is made up of molecules.
Hold on, Anthony. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Anthony Peake with us, his book, Opening the Doors of Perception. Anthony, I've always been fascinated with the savant syndrome, which you also touch on in the book.
I do indeed, yes. I mean, Savant syndrome has fascinated me for many years. And what I did was, I touched upon it in one of my earlier books, but I've been very intrigued by the work of a guy called Darrell Treffert, Dr. Darrell Treffert. And Treffert was the technical advisor for the movie Rain Man, because he worked very closely with Kim Peek from Utah, mm-hmm. the late Kim Peek, who died a couple of years ago. And Kim Peek had these most amazing abilities. And I argue that people who have Savant syndrome, their doors of perception are extraordinarily opened as well, because there's normally a link between Savant syndrome and autism, Savant syndrome and epilepsy, and various other areas of my Huxleyan spectrum. And I found that some of the people who have Savant syndrome are simply amazing. I mean, in the book, I discuss people like Carly Fleischman, and there's a guy called Tito Mukhopadhyay. These guys have really, really extreme experiences of the world around us. Now, if we look at autistic children, you will notice something. They seem to be in their own world, but they also seem to react very strongly to light and sounds and everything else. Mm-hmm. And this is because their doors of perception are open. And in fact, a guy called Bernard Rimland has called this high fidelity attention. So it is the fact that their doors are open and they can perceive things. But what is really, really interesting here, and is somebody you really need to get on the show if you're interested, is a lady called Dr. Diane Hennessy Powell.
Okay.
And she has a young girl from India called Haley, and she is telepathic. They have proven this child is telepathic in laboratory tests. The back story was that her mother is a mathematician, and Haley cannot communicate, as with some autistic children. She can only communicate using a keyboard because her verbal skills aren't very, very high. But when her mother used to test her, she used to ask her mathematical questions, and the child always got them right. And she typed the answers. And the mother was so interested, she contacted Darrell Treffert about her child. And they brought her over to the States. And he sent her to Diane Hennessy Powell's lab. And the child, they were testing the child one day. And the mathematician who was working with her got bored and thought, what's the answer in binary code? So she was doing a mathematical question. And she thought, the answer is, I don't know, 365 or something. And she thought, what would that be in binary code? And she thought, you know, and I know it's not, but it was something, you know, 0110111 or whatever. And the little girl typed on the keyboard 1000111.
Jeez.
And she went, you're not a mathematical savant. You're reading my mind. So get this, George. What the woman then did was she tested it, and she thought in her mind, if you're reading my mind, type I love you in German. And she typed, ich liebe dich.
Amazing.
And they went, oh, my God. So they started testing this child. Now, Diane has now got two or three others of these children. They're telepathic. This is absolute powerful evidence that telepathy exists. Now, if telepathy is proven to exist, communication between minds can happen. Now, our scientific paradigm cannot accommodate that at all. So this might be the first chink in the armor of the change of our present paradigm of scientific understanding to a wider paradigm that can explain consciousness and all the things you talk about in this show.
That is amazing. Let's talk about deja vu, the near-death experiences, OBEs, remote viewing, because you've looked at all of those too. They're all similar and they're all connected, aren't they?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. What is happening? What is happening here, really, with deja vu? It's, to want a better term, it's a glitch in the matrix. It's almost a memory of
an overlap, of memory or
yes.
something.
Now, there is the standard explanation. If you read most psychological books, they will give the explanation. It's called the Ephron hypothesis, and it was put forward by a guy called Robert Ephron in 1961, and it's called the visual pathways argument. And basically, in very simple terms, it means that your eyes see something, and that's fed to your non-dominant hemisphere, whereas the image that it's fed to your dominant hemisphere is slightly delayed, so you get this kind of echo effect, so you see things or you feel you've seen something before, but you've forgotten. But deja vus are much more powerful than that, aren't they? Deja vus are a feeling of otherworldliness, that you have done this before at some time in your past. Now, I've argued long and hard that the deja vu is exactly what it feels like. It's the fact that you have lived this moment before. And the answer to this, And the answer to the other things we're discussing, this reality we live in is a simulation. It's not what it seems. It's not physically real in the way we believe it to be real. And if it's a simulation, and the point I was making earlier on before the break, that if everything is related to everything else, we can move within what we consider to be three-dimensional space in out-of-the-body experiences, because there isn't any space out there. It's all mind-generated. It's all mind-generated. It's just we are locked into our bodies because we are not aware of the fact that it's a greater thing. Now, I argue that everything we perceive is an hallucination. So you're looking around your room now, you're listening, you're looking around the studio or whatever. Everything you're seeing, your brain is recreating inside your mind. This is the thing people don't grasp. They seem to think that I look at things and that's what they really are. They're not. There is not a one-to-one relationship between what you see and what is out there. And to believe that is to be placed in something called being a naive realist. And this is what scientists, that's a term the perception scientists use for people who believe that out there is what is inside. So if everything is brain generated, in the sense the brain takes all this information and recreates it for you in your mind, it means that that is as much an hallucination as any other brain generated hallucination. And in fact, there are two researchers that I discuss in the book called Green and McCreary, Celia Green and Charles McCreary, who have something called the metachoric model. And they argue that all perception is an hallucination. And if that is the case, we can explain hallucinations because everything is brain generated, which can then explain DMT, can explain out-of-the-body experiences, near-death experiences. They're all consciousness that is not located in the brain. This is the thing people get fooled into thinking. Because I have the perception that I'm looking at the world from behind my eyes, that I'm inside my brain. It's far more complex than that. There are things known in neurology. There's something called the binding problem. There are many things that modern neurologists cannot explain how the brain works unless the brain works non-locally and can communicate instantaneously. And I think this is because this is a simulation. We exist in a computer game. Our perceptions are downloaded into our minds from a huge simulation. And therefore, everything, you can travel anywhere within the simulation, just as you can do on Second Life.
Elon Musk, you know, founder of Tesla Motors and the space programs, believes totally. We're in a matrix.
Totally, and we are. I mean, this is when Musk made this statement, I was delighted. I had emails from around the world saying, crying out loud, this guy is saying what you're saying. I mean, I'm not unique in this. There are lots of other writers. But I think I'm the only one that's pulling it together into a structured, neurological, scientifically valid model of how reality is actually functioning. Now, if this is a simulation, and again, I suggest if anybody's interested, you know, Scientific American regularly carries articles on the holographic model of reality.
Yeah.
There's more and more research saying that the reality we perceive is holographic. And it's to do with black holes. It's really bizarre. It is to do with black holes and something called Hawking radiation. And again, in my papers, I've just recently written a chapter for a book on pandeism. And in that chapter, I discuss in detail how the simulation model can be used to explain extraordinary experiences.
How bizarre would it be, Anthony, if we were truly in a simulated model?
Well, wouldn't that be weird?
My
wouldn't it be even weirder, George, if, you know, we're becoming aware of the fact we're in a simulation? What does that mean for the simulation?
That's right. That's right.
That means the old transcendental meditation thing, isn't it? If more people do transcendental meditation, they can influence reality, which we all used to know about in the 60s. Here we have a situation where more people are becoming enlightened to the fact that it might be a simulation. The argument is, as well, and it's very, very interesting, George, is that the argument has been put together by a guy called Nick Bostrom, who argues that the people who have created the simulation are our own descendants. It's our own selves in the future that have created ancestor sims, and we exist within the ancestor sims.
You know, when I was a kid, I always used to think that Earth might have been on like a flea on a dog, that there was something bigger and something bigger than that and something bigger than that. That was almost the same of saying we're in a matrix, isn't it?
It is. It is. But don't we all do this? You know, and in those moments when you wake up in the middle of the night and you suddenly, for a split second, you realize what you really are. We all spend our time being a father or a grandfather or a son or a business person or a radio interviewer. And that's what we believe we are. But it's only when you start looking inside to think, well, how weird this is. I am something that is perceiving something. Isn't that just weird beyond it? Why does anything exist rather than nothing? You know, how can atoms coming together in my mind, reacting with electricity, create me, and indeed create a consciousness that can wonder what atoms are? You know, the whole thing is just so
mind-boggling
and incredible. But most people never ever think about the sheer amazing fact that you are a conscious something. You know, why should chemicals in your brain create consciousness? Consciousness is non-physical. How can something that is physical create something that is completely non-physical? It's what David Chalmers, the Australian philosopher, calls the hard problem of science. And until we can cure the hard problem of science, and I think the answer lies in stuff that we're discovering now with dark energy and dark matter, is that this is all to do with the fact that the brain doesn't create consciousness. It's a receiver of consciousness. Consciousness isn't there. Just like everybody now listening to my voice through their radio receiver. I'm not in your computer. You can take the back off the computer and you won't find George Norrie and Anthony Peake there. Because you won't. It's not there.
We are
miles away. I'm over in England. George is over in the States. But what is happening is you would, quite naturally, if you didn't know any better, assume we were inside your computer or inside your radio receiver.
Yes.
But we're not.
If we didn't know better.
We make with consciousness. We assume because consciousness manifests or seems to manifest within the brain, that's where it is.
Anthony, in the book, Opening the Doors of Perception, what would you say was the single just mind-blowing thing that you put together?
Right, that's an excellent question. That is a really excellent question.
Because there are many things in there.
I think that probably it's the things to do with the Japanese. There are three or four cases that are cited of individuals who are permanently deja vuing. They are in permanent states whereby they know what's going to happen next. Not only that, but they believe they have lived this life not once, but many, many times. There was one guy who, in the end, committed suicide because he couldn't stand it. There is one lady who is cited who says that she stopped playing tennis because she knows the outcome of every rally. And scientists, instead of scientists going to these people and saying, can you prove that you can see short term into the future? They don't. They don't ask those questions. They conclude, precognition is impossible, therefore we don't even look at it. Now, with this kind of weird deja vu sensation, this again for me is evidence that this is a simulation. And it's not only a simulation, George, it is also a simulation in which you can live your life over and over again. Imagine, for instance, that our future descendants has programmed George Norrie's life. And like a computer game, it's the George Norrie game.
Mm-hmm.
And in the game, like when you normally play a normal computer game, like for instance Lara Croft in Tomb Raider,
right.
You load the game, Lara's on the screen, and boom, she's just born. You switch the computer on and there's a little sprite on the screen. You guide her. She runs down a corridor, goes into a room and gets eaten by a monster. She's then reborn. So as far as she's concerned, all her memories are wiped and she's reborn again. But you as the game player remember what happened last time. So little Lara, imagine Lara on the screen is kind of vaguely conscious. She gets born again and she's walking down and suddenly there's this feeling that she shouldn't go into this room because it's dangerous. So she goes down another corridor and gets eaten again. And the same thing happens. I believe that that is what happens with our lives. I believe there is a program from the zero point field of George Norrie's life containing all the outcomes of every decision that George Norrie could make during his life. And each time you play the game and live the life, you follow a different route. And there is part of you, what I call the daemon, the game player of your life, the real you, that exists outside of time and space. The viewer from outside, he plays the game for you, and he warns you sometimes of dangers. In order for you to live the perfect life, in order for you to fulfill every ambition and every outcome that you could possibly do. Now, this is what happens in the movie Groundhog Day. You know, the Connors in Groundhog Day does exactly this. This is the great secret. This reality is a simulated reality, and you are within it, and you can fulfill every outcome. I mean, George, have you ever had in your life that feeling, I shouldn't do this?
Oh, yes, many times. And I start reacting to it now, Anthony. I never did before. Really? Now I listen.
Can you give an example? Have you had any examples?
Well, here's one. I've talked about it on the show before, and it had to do with me in a car coming up to an intersection, and I had the right of way. I had the green light. And as I'm getting close to the intersection and the light is green and people are behind me, something said, don't go through. Don't go through. Pull over. Stop. Do whatever you have to do, but do not go through the intersection. And I'm thinking to myself, the light's green. I got to go. I got people behind me. But this feeling, Anthony, was so compelling that I stopped and I pulled over a little bit to the side. And at that instant, where I would have been right in the middle of the intersection, somebody came roaring through their red light doing about 65 miles an hour. They would have broadsided me and probably killed me. Now, that to me was the most poignant thing that I can remember and recall in terms of that feeling within yourself, and you do have to listen. The old me would have gone through that intersection.
I would argue, George, the old you did go through that intersection and you were killed. And in this life, this game, your daemon, your higher self, has managed to communicate from remembering. I guarantee you, coming up to that intersection, your daemon will probably go, God, I remember this now. I've got to do something. I've got to stop George doing this. And he does it.
Or again.
Or whatever. Now, I've come across case after case after case of this. In my book, The Daemon, A Guide to Your Extraordinary Secret Self, that's the central theme of this, that book that I wrote about, what, 8 years ago now?
Yeah.
And so many people contacted me after that book, citing experiences like yours. They are so common. And again, this is again the thing I was saying earlier, that we have to wake up to these things. So many people experience.
Oh, my God, yeah. When we take calls next hour, of course, I'd like phone calls and questions for you, Anthony, but I'd like people to share their stories, much like I just did with you.
Please, this because is important to me.
They are out there.
I want to hear the stories.
They are truly out there. Now, what causes it? Why? What's behind it?
Right. What's behind it is, as I said, is that, and I can't prove this, but funnily enough, there are people now approaching me thinking, how can we prove this? In fact, I did a talk for the Society for Psychical Research in London 2 weeks ago, and one of Britain's top astronomers, Professor Bernard Carr, was in the audience, and he came over to me and he said, Anthony, your ideas are absolutely incredible. How can we find ways to scientifically work with you in terms of trying to develop these ideas? So suddenly really top academics are waking up to what I'm writing and going, this guy is not some new age woo, this guy really has got something. And I believe that we are in a simulation, and I believe that it is, we are in some form of computer program. And I definitely believe that we live our lives many, many times. And this would explain deja vu, wouldn't it, George?
It sure would.
If you've lived this life many, many times, you will have memories. You know, sometimes you meet somebody and you go, I know you. I know you for some reason. Or there's other people where you think, I need to not talk to that person because it's dangerous.
And you're connected. Anthony, we're going to take the break. We're going to open up the phone lines. Let's get questions for you and perhaps stories as well. And I have to ask you about deja vu when we come back, because an episode occurred to me back in the summer that still has me shaking my head. I'll be back in a moment.